Yesterday, Chuck covered a good deal of ground. One of his four topics was the challenge to the church of the rich-poor gap. And he raised the question of how we, as citizens of the rich world, ought to, as the church in the rich world, minister. So I have decided to make a change of topic from the one that I was going to do today and address some initial remarks or some remarks to that question of what form ought the church take in the rich world? What ought to be the marks of the churches of which all of us are a part in a world that is desperately poor, but as we live in churches and in a world which is not. On the contrary, it is affluent. And yet we live in a precarious time, a time with an ominous future that more and more of us sense. So how ought we to be church in this kind of world? I have a rough outline. The first part is to spend a little bit of time on a kind of theological understanding of the relationship of guilt, responsibility, and freedom. And I'll pick up a couple of things that Walt talked about in the Bible study this morning. And then I want to try just a few kind of marks or characteristics of the church that might be appropriate characteristics of the church in the rich world, but facing this ominous future for rich and poor alike. Those marks are the church as a community of common grace. Say something about each of these. A church as a community anticipating the future and trying some things in anticipation of a different kind of future also for us, not only for the poor. The church as what I will call a sacred stranger in a secular society. The church as a community of the nerve of failure. It's turning that phrase around. Not the failure of nerve, but the nerve of failure. The church as a community of enough. And the church is a community of hope. And just a few words as we get to each of those, and then some time to discuss. First, then, some understanding for our situation of the relationship of guilt, responsibility, and freedom. I remind you that there is a sheet here that Chuck passed out, a yellow sheet, which has a splendid paragraph on the back on the relationship of guilt and responsibility. I just remind you of that. I will not be exegeting that. A sense of responsibility for the future generations and for the present poor in a time of uncertainty and when more and more of us are feeling the future as ominous or sensing it as ominous, a sense of responsibility for the future generations and for the present poor almost runs full grain against the prevailing ethos. Under the a sense of feeling constraints and under a fear of cataclysm even, the psychology of the day is everyone for himself or everyone for herself. The psychology of the day tends to be everyone for himself or herself or his or her own economic class or our nation, or our business, or some other form of human tribalism. That is to say, human solidarity, which is never very extensive at best, is doubly tenuous when people feel that the future is ominous, so that the competition for scarce goods escalates and cooperation for the common good falls. There is a book that Walt and I were talking about yesterday that both of us use in classes, a book by Langdon Gilkey called Chan Tung Compound, and it just describes the experience of those American missionaries and their families and American businessmen and their families and other members of the American community in China when the Japanese took over in the 40s, and they were all put in there, and they were given the freedom to construct their own society within the camp. The Japanese guarded the camp, so they weren't about to leave, but they had to decide how to be a community within the camp and run things for themselves. And Gilkey mentions in passing, he says, it was easy to be altruistic, it was easy to be generous when some of us had two bedrooms, and someone needed a place to sleep. But when we only had one bedroom, and we were asked to share that, then it was very, very difficult. That is to say, cooperation for the common good was much easier under the conditions of abundance than it was under the condition of competition for scarce resources. So our sense of responsibility for future generations and the present poor tends to diminish when we feel further constraints rather than when we have a sense of a wide open and an affluent future. Okay. Sometimes there is a kind of counter dynamic that prevails, and we'll see this too. That is to say, when people feel faced with a common threat, sometimes they close ranks and they achieve a degree of cooperation and solidarity that was not present when the threat didn't exist. So under the conditions of war, for example, you may get yourself together. A person has said that what we ought to be praying for these days in the world such as ours is an invasion from Mars. Maybe we'd get our act together in the face of a common threat that was from the outside and that threatened all of us. President Carter's reference to the energy challenge as the moral equivalent of war was designed precisely to connote that there was a common threat and that what was called for was common sacrifice and common cooperation. Now, it hasn't worked, mostly because we don't believe that there is this common threat. We don't know which of these two psychologies will prevail in the years ahead. I think they will battle one another, and probably within the psyches of the very same persons, we ourselves will fluctuate between feeling we've got to conserve, that is to say, protect what we have, and some other genuinely cooperative ventures for the common good. Yet, what concerns me is that both the competitive efforts and the cooperative efforts proceed with only a very limited future in mind. That is, we don't look very far into the future, whichever of these two we're talking about. So the present generation is our concern, maybe our children's generation, but not much beyond that. Decisions we make are decisions for the short term, for tomorrow, at best a decade hence, not for the long term, not for the coming generations, even though the scientific community tells us day in and day out that what we are doing now will likely have its greatest impact several generations hence. And also the kind of solutions that we need to be looking at are solutions which we must begin now. For example, we know we're going to be running out of fossil fuels sometime down the line, not in our lifetime. And the scientific community keeps telling us, if you're going to get the society in place that is going to be able to operate on something other than fossil fuels, you have to start now. Science and Technology Committee has been responsible in that way, but I submit that that is not where most American, for Holden Village, that is not where most Americans are. Well, when all of the pressures are these immediate ones, what kind of stance, what kind of bearing, what kind of self-understandings allows some people to act responsibly in the face of an ominous future? What kind of stance allows people a fund of courage to take risks for a future that they will never see, and allows people who themselves feel complicit in the injustice of the present, that is to say, who themselves feel as the rich responsible for much of the of the present injustices generated by their present way of living. They want to change their present way of living, but they sense an ominous future. What kind of stance permits that? And that's why I want to talk about the relationship here, responsibility, guilt, and freedom, especially understood theologically. I want to cite just a couple of sentences from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer was in a situation in which he was a child of privilege and power, but where he found himself facing an ominous future, and he wanted to act responsibly for the coming generations, even though he knew that his own time was a time of letting go, of relinquishment. He, in the Ethics, has some thoughts on what he calls the deed of free responsibility. Now, it's an extraordinary deed for extraordinary times. It's not common fare for common times. It breaks with familiar patterns. It risks a different definition of what is good, and it breaks with past habits. Bonhoeffer says that this risky deed of responsibility for people who still have some leverage on the future, they're not like so many of the poor with no choices, but for people who still have some room to move, this risky deed of responsibility on behalf of future generations includes, as he says, both readiness to accept guilt and freedom. And I want to sort of unpack that. For Bonhoeffer, there are two meanings for this phrase, the acceptance of guilt. They're very different. I wish he hadn't used the same phrase for both of them. I just warn you about that. Two very different meanings. The first meaning of acceptance of guilt necessary for this deed of free responsibility is the one that we would think of, the acknowledgement that the very people called upon to make risks for the future, namely us, are deeply implicated in the state of affairs that requires drastic transformation. That is, we've tried to say over this couple of week and a half that our way of life is part, not all of, but part of the reason why there is a rich-poor gap and why it is growing. Bonhoeffer says, if we're going to take risks for the future, we've got to accept our complicity in the state of affairs that requires the drastic transformation, so that we are morally complicit in the conditions that have brought us to this place. For Bonhoeffer, that was a reference to what lodged with his own class, his own nation, and his own church, and the responsibility of that for the rise of the Third Reich. For us, it's our rather massive contributions to the yawning chasms that divide rich and poor, and the chasm between the health of the human family and the health of the planet, which is also tenuous because of the course of a wasteful industrial way of life. Bonhoeffer says that the possibility of our breaking with our entrenched habits and the institutions that have formed around them and risking for the future requires this coming to terms with our past, requires what the New Testament calls metanoia, repentance, which is turning around and change of mind, change of perspective. Or the Hebrew term for repentance is actually turning around, going a different direction. The Greek word is a change of mind, which is seeing things differently and then acting in accord with this different outlook on life. But neither turning around nor seeing things differently happens, Bonhoeffer says, without acceptance of guilt. Now, it's precisely those who acknowledge complicity that are called upon to risk the deed of free responsibility. Precisely those who have been involved to this point that are charged with further responsibility. I was struck at the end of Don Hines's session yesterday on the Indians of the Inland Northwest, where Don, after these gripping speeches by Indian chiefs, where you could just see the breakdown of the Indian community in interaction with the white community, both being attracted to white men's culture and being destroyed by it, both being repelled by it and being lured by it. At the end, Don's own conclusions were that the white man still has an extraordinary power for the future of the Indian. Even though the Indians have to do it themselves, the white culture still can stop that. And so it is with the rich and the poor. The poor have very little power, so it is in fact yet those who have some leverage on the future and some range of choice that have to make some of the crucial moves. And Bonhoeffer also knows that. So it is that the people that are who acknowledge guilt are also the ones, namely us, who are crucial to the exercise of responsibility. Now, repentance, Bonhoeffer says, is a foundation for new patterns. That's why acceptance of guilt is a precondition of repentance. Okay. How does creativity and risk emerge from the acceptance of guilt? Not easily is the answer. And there's a paragraph that I want to read. Bonhoeffer thinks there are some theological stipulations that have psychological consequences. I want to read this. Civil courage can only grow out of the free responsibility of free people. Only now are the Germans beginning to discover the meanings of free responsibility. It depends on a God who demands responsible action and a bold venture of faith, and who promises forgiveness and consolation to the person who becomes a sinner in that venture. Let me read that last part again. How to discover free responsibility. It depends on a God who demands who demands responsible action and a bold venture of faith, and who promises forgiveness and consolations to the person who becomes a sinner in that venture. Let's unpack that. Here's the second meaning, and a very different one, of the term acceptance of guilt. What Bonhoeffer means, I think it has terrific implications or applications for us. The acceptance of guilt is the accepting the consequences of necessarily risky decisions, consequences which, in our ambiguous situation and in the face of the dilemmas that we've fashioned for ourselves, decisions which themselves may well incur harm and play into new patterns of evil. You can't do something without hurting somebody. It isn't a win-win situation that we've gotten ourselves into. There are some, and that's great, but there are lots of others where we have genuine dilemmas on our hands. Yeah. Acceptance of guilt here, the second meaning, means accepting the consequences of necessarily risky actions on our part. Some of those consequences may well incur further harm.
Could I throw in an illustration?
Yeah, sure.
Thinking of international economic order, I don't know if you were here, Jan, when we talked about that. If you let the poor, if you relinquish control of the system which keeps the industrial jobs in the north and let the poor countries do more of the processing of their own stuff, their own raw materials, which is one of the demands, you're going to throw some people in the north out of work.
Your example of tomatoes, and should we boycott the tomatoes from Mexico? You know, and if we do boycott them, what are the consequences for those poor Mexicans that depend upon?
In the short run, you may hurt some Mexicans by doing that.
And we've got 100 of these kind of situations. Now, how do we keep that, knowing that, from paralyzing us?
You can always come up with a reason for not doing anything in this area.
Yeah.
Because you can always say, well, but you're going to hurt so-and-so if you do that. Of course you are. Sure.
And our response is to, when we see these genuine dilemmas, is to be morally paralyzed. Now it turns out that is also...
Or to use it as an excuse for not changing the status quo.
Yeah.
That happens too, I think.
And Bonhoeffer wants to say that if one... Well, I'll just try to carry on here. To both acknowledge this complicity in the present state of affairs, and yet to be free to break with these patterns, even though it risks new evils, depends on, Bonhoeffer says, on a God who promises forgiveness and consolation. That is to say, the good Lutheran emphasis here that we haven't picked up the way we should have for this rich-poor gap, anyway. What is being asserted is really the classic and the radical Christian contention that because God accepts us unconditionally, those who ought to be disqualified because of their pasts, judged by all human scales of assessment, are set free to venture a different future. That is to say, we can undertake a different future because God forgives, even when we know that that future venture holds no immunity from making further wrong choices. That's the kind of radical freedom that the gospel proclaims. Because God forgives, the very people who brought on the darkness are freed to help effect something different.
Even the Egyptians.
Yeah.
Get involved with God's justice.
Even when they know that some of their future actions will also carry their own dark side, that we will become a sinner in the venture.
Isn't that like Luther's sin bravely?
Oh, my next paragraph!
She's with you.
Exactly. That famed line from Luther, which has gotten around even to the back side of the room. Sin boldly, and then, but believe in Christ and rejoice more boldly still. Let me just illustrate from Bonhoeffer's situation. He felt morally complicit for the rise of the Third Reich. Now, his guilt was not a direct one. You're not talking about someone who was a Nazi and then woke up and repented from that. He just felt that his nation, his class, and his church could have and should have prevented the rise of Hitler, and then found all sorts of rationalizations not to stop Hitler once Hitler got entrenched, didn't take the risks on behalf of the Jews, for example.
And in some ways he benefited from a system that led to that, even though he didn't create the system.
Yeah. So he felt responsible, even though not always guilty to the same degree that other people were guilty. And this was his situation, and this ringing affirmation to take risky decisions for the future generations, even though he was morally complicit, was grounded in this picture of God as one who promises sinners to people who will become, and promises forgiveness to sinners who will become, continue to be sinners in the future. So sin boldly, but believe in Christ and rejoice more boldly still.
And it reminds me of that Seattle speech where he said, "Man is just a strand in the web." What you do to the web, you do to yourself.
Yeah.
So any action that you make, it's going to come back on us.
Yeah. Yeah. There, Father Abraham Heschel, Rabbi Heschel, great rabbi who also came out of this time, though, as a Jew and came out of the Holocaust, said that all are responsible, but not all are equally guilty. Likewise, in our situation, we aren't all equally guilty for the rich-poor gap. However, people with power and influence and some leverage on the future are all responsible for the future. We are also guilty in some ways and in some often a great degree. Okay, that I don't think we've really caught the gospel there yet on what kind of freedom we have as the rich in the face of the rich-poor gap to risk a different future. It addresses the moral paralysis that we feel when our consciousness is raised. Now I want to talk then about some marks of the church. Someone needs to... Our house was lightly burgled a few years ago and my wristwatch was taken in that, and I've got along so much better without it. I wasn't constantly looking at the clock to see if I was going to be late or early or on time even. And so I have to ask my neighbor now to watch the clock, or someone to watch the clock, because I don't...
When do you want to be called?
Alarm
to go off.
Well, we need to make sure we've got some time for this discussion. What time is it?
Quarter after would give you 17 minutes.
Oh, yeah, make it 10 after.
All right.
Okay, some quick marks of the church. How ought the church to look? A church that would take risky decisions for an unknown future. One thing is that in a time of transition, in a time of great change, in a time when lots of people are experiencing a great deal of confusion, in a time when a lot of people really have this sense of possible catastrophe and are preoccupied with big things, somebody needs to be around just to affirm the common, ordinary, everyday expressions of God's grace. There's a nice piece in G.K. Chesterton's book, The Man Who Was Thursday. There are two poets there, Mr. Gregory and Mr. Syme, and they're having a vigorous debate about what it is that art is all about. And through Mr. Syme, G.K. Chesterton makes a point. After Mr. Gregory states his claim that the artist is an anarchist, Gregory says, the poet delights in disorder only. Then he goes on to say, Gregory, why all the clerks in the navies and the railway trains look so sad and tired, so very sad and tired? I will tell you, it is because they know the train is going right. It is because they know that whatever place they have a ticket for, that place they will reach. It's boring. It is because after they've passed Sloane Square, they know that the next station must be Victoria and nothing but Victoria. Oh, their wild rapture. Oh, their eyes like stars and their souls again in Eden if the next station were unaccountably Baker Street. And then Syme answers Mr. Gregory, and he's the other side of the debate here and what art is about. It is you who are unpoetical. If what you say of the clerks is true, they can only be as prosaic as your poetry. The rare strange thing is to hit the mark. The gross, obvious thing is to miss it. We feel it is epical when man with one wild arrow strikes a distant bird. Is it not also epical when man with one wild engine strikes a distant station? Chaos is dull, because in chaos the trains might indeed go anywhere, to Baker Street or to Baghdad. But man is a magician, and the whole of his magic is in this, that when he says Victoria, lo, it is Victoria. I tell you, Syme goes on then with passion, that every time a train comes in, I feel that it has broken past batteries of besiegers and that man has won a battle against chaos.
Especially if it's on time.
You say contemptuously that when one has left Sloane Square, one must come to Victoria. I say that one might do 1,000 things instead, and that whenever I really come there, I have a sense of hairbreadth escape. And when I hear the guard shout out the word Victoria, it is not an unmeaning word. It is to me indeed Victoria. It is the victory of Adam. Part of being the church, precisely in times of drastic discontinuity, which is what we're in and in for, is celebrating what Chesterton calls the victory of Adam, grateful that the next station is Victoria, just as expected, so that the routine character of day-to-day goodness is to be held high, just as we do in the bread and the wine and the sacrament. Precisely in the times that are turning times, the church should do its part to engender awe that the sun comes up one more day, or that people fall and stay in love, or that the bus continues to run. That has a terrific sort of rooting of our lives in the time of discontinuity. Eden, Gregory here contends, signals the dramatically creative, and that is necessary. but so is the victory of Adam, which is a reference to that naming of Adam in Genesis 2, by which humanity has its part in God's creative order so as to hold chaos at bay and make routine, make goodness routine. We need just to point to the magic that there's another meal on the table, and that when the conductor announces Victoria, lo, it's Victoria, not Baghdad. Well, okay. But shalom, wholeness, is much more than this experience of common grace and a community of common grace. So I want to point to some other things which face the discontinuity rather than hold up the continuity. There are few things so vital in a time of transition, of massive change, as anticipatory communities. Chuck touched on this yesterday. That is to say, there are few communities so important for all of us than those communities which are experiments in new patterns of life together. Communities that will take the time to work out in nuts and bolts fashion, trial and error fashion, over a protracted period of time, some new way of organizing human community. We're in a time when everyone is telling us what's wrong with industrial society. We're also in a time when there aren't yet enough clear pictures of which way to go. And you need, in this in-between time, these anticipatory communities, these communities that work at, in trial and error fashions, new possibilities, and thereby give social form to a hoped-for future and show people that are caught up in their present that someone's already over there, has tried it, and it works. It has taken recognizable shape. So that's one thing the church can do. Whether we will is another question. Some interesting attempts are being made. Some exciting attempts are being made to be precisely those anticipatory community, and maybe in our discussion we can point to some of those. A second thing the church can and ought to be in such a time is what the sociologist Howard Becker calls the sacred stranger in secular society. That is to say, in times of transition, people need to be empowered by the traditions that are resources for them. That is to say, and that's what the sacred stranger part of this. The church needs to immerse itself into its own traditions and find there are lots of things that it didn't see before or forgot. We need to work through the biblical materials again, find out that they address life under conditions of constraints and limits and scarcity, and still talk about the abundant life and the joyful existence. We haven't really understood that. We need to immerse ourselves into the resources of our faith. That will make it look like we're strangers in the society, because you go deep into that which distinguishes you rather than that which you hold in common with the whole culture. And yet, a sacred stranger in secular society. It means a disengagement from the American success story on the one hand, and then a re-engagement in American culture, having the prophetic anguish for the people that Jeremiah had, for example. So the church is a stranger, becomes a kind of loving adversary over against American society in one of its moments. We need to disengage, and on the other hand, we need to re-engage out of deep concern, which is also our concern for our own well-being in that society. The church needs to be, ought to be, can be, in some places is, a community of the nerve of failure. That's a phrase from another sociologist, David Riesman. And Riesman says that there need to be what he calls utopian communities who will not engage in what Reisman calls the lesser evil thinking that poses immediate alternatives. And in times like ours, we're inclined to find what we call the practical solution. And by that we mean something we can do, but which in fact is for the short term only, and may in fact be destructive of long term good. And he calls that lesser evil thinking. You choose among present alternatives. The trouble is, those alternatives depend upon the system that is itself wrong. They are the alternatives posed by that system. There need to be some communities of the nerve of failure, someone who will try some thinking which is thinking alternative to the present possibilities. But to do that, you have to be willing to accept failure, because they'll be frustrated again and again and again. So you have to have the nerve of failure. So he says, lesser evil thinking poses immediate alternatives, and that in the end is not even practical. That's the irony of it. And we need communities that will engage in that thinking, in Reisman's terms, which confronts us with great hopes and great plans. Just a quick flashback to the biblical communities. On their better days, and they had some days were better than others, but on their better days, both Israel and the early church were communities with great hopes and great plans, and as the constraints were pushed upon them, they dreamed grander dreams. And if you look at the prophets of the exile, for example, it's precisely when the people were feeling more and more constraints that the grander visions, which actually liberated them to a grander future, were generated. So one needs that kind of thinking in those kinds of communities which will confront us with great hopes and great plans just when the dreams of a lot of people are dying, when constraints are felt to be multiplying. On the face of it, and in the short term, that will not be practical in our ordinary sense of that. It's the way of the fool. I love the image from Ruben Alves' book, Tomorrow's Child, a book which I commend you, even though we don't have it on our list. Alves says, taking Jeremiah again as his favorite prophet, Jeremiah, just as Jeremiah bought a piece of land when it looked like that was a very bad investment, as Jeremiah's symbolic act that is going to stick around for a long-term future. So Alves says, all of us are going to be inclined to plant pumpkins instead of dates, because when you plant pumpkins, you can reap the harvest in 6 months. Everybody's going to be planting pumpkins. We're going to have hordes of pumpkins. Nobody's going to be planting dates. That is to say, something which will provide sustenance and well-being for the future generations, because we won't see the fruit of the date tree. It takes that long. So we'll kind of bury ourselves in pumpkins, and there won't be dates for the future generations. Where are the communities that are willing to plant dates?
Larry, you're planting dates, but it's pumpkin harvest time. The short run time is up. You want to quickly review the other three?
All right.
Just the skeleton.
Yeah, the community of enough. That is what Chuck was talking about yesterday. A community that says enough is enough. Communities of kind of new asceticism. That is to say, people who will willingly choose for themselves a life of simpler living, a life of kind of joyful cutting back as a way of anticipating a different future. And then
conspicuous under consumption.
Yeah, good. And then lastly, a community of hope. And since my limit has run out here, I just want to close with a verse from from Romans, the church's grounds for hope are very different from grounds for optimism. Optimism and hope are very different terms, because optimism is a word which takes its clue from an assessment of possibilities or probabilities. It takes its clue from a reading of the facts. Hope has a different dynamic. It does not take its assessment from prognoses. It takes its clues from the power of God to bring something out of the present that we cannot anticipate even by looking at the present conditions. And I have a quotation that I like from Richard Shaw. We die when we settle for the limited possibilities of a dying order. We come alive and we become agents of transformation when we begin to live now the as yet unrealized possibilities around us whose time has come. The church, even when all of its seeing is through a glass darkly, the church's trust is certain, because it trusts in the possibility of transformation, because it is God's possibility, and for no other reason. And that's enough. Take a good look at the fourth chapter of Romans. For when hope was hopeless, Abraham, contemplating his own body as good as dead, and knowing as well the deadness of Sarah's tomb, yet put his trust in God. Here's the marvelous last line of that verse. The God who makes the dead live and summons things that are not yet in existence as if they already were. Summons things that are not yet into existence as if they already were. There needs to be a community that holds out that hope of the possibilities of a different order of life, even when looking around you, you can't see what it might or could even possibly be. Grander hopes, grander dreams. Okay.
Let me send around, for any of you who don't have it, this little paragraph of Goulet on the relationship between guilt and responsibility. I think you'll find it suggestive.
Yeah.
If you already have one, or if one of a couple has one, don't take any more. 15 whole minutes.
Let's just open it up. These have been, by and large, kind of sketches and theological sketches. We haven't gotten to those important questions of what, in fact, ought the church to do, concrete matters. We do want to schedule next week an evening forum. No, Sunday night, I guess, about 9:30, we would like to have one forum. And it will be not a panel of thing, but just an open discussion on living more simply, and talk about concrete matters. What are people doing? What are people's observations of what people are doing? That's one dimension of this. It's only one, but it is one important one. Oh, excuse me, Glenn.
Yeah. Will some of what you've gone through be in your new book?
Yeah. Fleshed out. Yeah.
I guess listening to what you're saying about community, those kinds of ideas, at least for me, have been floating around for the last 10 years or so.
Yeah.
But the question that inevitably comes, and thank goodness for the forum, is how do you manifest that? How do you do that? And I really wonder if it just seems as if we spend a lot of time theorizing.
Yeah.
But how do we make this come alive? How do we do it? How do we make it happen?
Or who is doing it?
What are the signs of it?
Bolling's first law. Kenneth Bolling is an American economist. He has a wonderful first law that's called Bolling's first law. Everything that exists is possible. I think it's just marvelous. People say, you can't do that. And then you look around and find out that someone did it or is doing it. There are communities that are doing a number of these things.
When will the forum be?
Pardon?
When will the forum be?
The one on simpler living will be Sunday night, 9:30.
Please make a tape of it.
Hmm?
Please make a tape of it.
Can't you be here at 9:30?
I'm in Fourth July, Jason.
That's part of the problem. It's impossible around here to find a time when nothing else is going on.
Yeah.
Larry?
Yes.
Could you help us, help me at least, with an illustration of the longer term rather than the shorter term planning that's been effectuated sometime? I'm not necessarily asking for proof documentation, but an example of it. One mustn't push examples too hard, but your pumpkins and dates, for example, when I listen to that, go through, and it comes out sort of, if I buy a piece of land in Chelan, which has nothing on it, and I'm going to plant pumpkins or dates, apples, I suppose would be a little better. I may very well opt for apples. Not because I'll live to see them, perhaps, but because I know that the value of a piece of land with apple trees planted on it is substantially larger than without apple trees planted on it. That's a very short-range decision, because I'm not going to pick those apples. I'm going to sell the land next year, and I'll make more money selling land with apples planted, even though I never see the fruit, than I would growing pumpkins. Now, that's a very short-range economic determination. And I'm wondering whether or not there is, in Boulding's observation, that there ever has been or can be a long-term decision, or whether it simply is an accretion of short-term decisions.
Yeah.
And so forth.
Yeah. I think it's the latter, but with the particular stipulation on those decisions. Namely, what are the consequences for the long term of our decisions, whether they are short term in their impact or not?
So you're really saying we've got to be fools in the short term.
Well, it may be that. There's a tribe in the Sierra Leone that has actually lived according to its maxim that one does not leave the jungle in any worse shape than one found it. Now, that affects its day-to-day short-term decisions, but the effect of it is a steady state economy there. And what we're really talking about, or what of our day-to-day decisions are ones which in the long term will provide dates or the conditions of well-being, because a lot of our decisions, short-term goals, conflict with long-term goals.
I also think it's hard for any political decision makers to operate that way, at least in our kind of system, and we shouldn't probably expect them to, because the next election is never very far off, and their own constituency is never very big spatially. It is usually at most it's one nation. I mean, there's no politician in the world today who has as constituency the global family. And yet a lot of the decisions have to be made on that basis. Well, who are the constituents pushing politicians, political decision makers, to make globally responsible decisions, as opposed to what's best for my congressional district or even my nation? And I think we can't expect that from the politicians. That is, they won't take the lead in it, but some of their constituents may. And there may be a body of conscience within a constituency that pushes politicians to make globally responsible decisions. But it's hard to find much evidence of that so far. Now, I don't look to politicians for those initiatives in decision making that look beyond our time and our space. But I certainly look for some others to do that. The church, economists, environmentalists.
But if I hear you, correctly, the way to be responsible for the long term may be to ask, what can you repeat the short term decision again and again and again without seeing long term detrimental consequences?
Many of us grew up with...
Is it a renewable decision that doesn't deplete?
Yeah, many of us grew up with farmers or in families of farmers who operated that way and tried to leave the land always in as good shape for the future as they got it. In fact, many of them thought they were improving the land, its fertility, its ability to produce food. I think there are still farmers like that around, but I know there are also some short-term gain farmers who don't care that much.
Let me tell you, I just couldn't figure out why the Japanese whaling industry was insistent upon continuing to take a large crop of whales every year when they knew that they would run themselves right out of business. I mean, to me, it just made absolutely no sense whatsoever to kill the whales to that degree that you would, in fact, be out of your own job.
Spend the capital as well as the interest is what they were doing. They were dipping into the capital.
Yeah, but you know what Paul Ehrlich reported on meeting with Japanese whalers? And they had it figured out. They know that the whales will be gone in 15 years. But they are currently having a profit margin of about 12%. And so what they've done is plan on killing off the whales and in the meantime shift the resources gained in capital to another industry. And then they will go at that at a high rate of margin. Well, the consequences of that kind of thing is, you know, are obvious. But that's the dynamics, so much of the dynamics of the present system. It's hard to break through that.
I have trouble rationalizing this simple life. You can look at the Mennonite system of farming, for instance. Suppose we all went back to that. What would everybody be doing if left over? There's only a certain amount that could live on the land.
Well, a lot more people would be living on the land, for one thing. A lot more people would be farming because it would be more human labor intensive, wouldn't it?
But it wouldn't support the rest of the people. Everybody's self-sufficient on the land.
Yeah, of course that isn't... I mean, I guess this is one of the things for the forum, is to share different pictures of what people mean by living more simply. I think for most people into that movement, it is not... For some people it is, but for most it is not going back to something that is picked up from the past and idealized as the way of life. It's finding a way ahead in the situation in which we find ourselves, and not just... going back. For example, Schumacher's call for appropriate or intermediate technology is not a call to use more primitive technology, just because our heavy industrial technology is labor intensive and capital intensive, and in the long run overtaxes the Earth's resources. It's a call for a kind of technology which has not yet been invented, needs to be invented, a sophisticated technology that is also labor intensive. So thus we need to work out new patterns of urban living, for example, which share the resources of people rather than all of them owning all of the stuff that you see in all of the houses. Well, that isn't going back to the way the city once was. It's finding a new way of living in the city that's appropriate.
What was that verse in Romans 4?
It's the 20. Let me give it to you. I think it's 20, 21, but 17. Romans 4, 17 to 21 portions, the phrases from that that I use.
Larry, I made a note when you were in your first section on the rich still being in a position to do certain things, even though they've created the problem, or the oppressors, or the Egyptians. They are also in a position to take some actions. And what occurred to me is maybe the most positive and not passive but active thing the rich can do is to get out of the way, or to relinquish, or to let go. I'd just like your reaction to that. If the Egyptians were being asked by God to let go, to let the people go, and if the poor today are saying, get out of our way, let the system operate so that it serves us as well as you without stacking the deck. You know, relinquish your unfair present advantage, which I think is one of the words clearly coming from the poor. Is that an active thing for the rich to do? Is relinquishment an active, positive step? And can the rich ever do it? I mean, is it possible that the rich can do that?
Well, with certain, if you're talking about large groups of people, one doesn't voluntarily relinquish much. That's
you don't give
only
up
for
power
small.
Voluntarily.
No group ever gives up power voluntarily. At least when you're talking about large collectives of people, when you're talking about nations.
Unless
so
the pain of not giving up power becomes too great.
Sometimes the self-interest is in the interest of giving up. But usually in order to, the consequences are worse. You'll lose more if you don't give up some.
Yeah, yeah. But
relinquishment and letting go and giving up may be something that some people can do voluntarily if they do it in community with support for one another. However, for massive change is always that's really effective is only done by pressures upon us that we would do not elect of ourselves. And so we need to be transformed, just as Jacob found himself in the midst of the wrestle because he was attacked with the night visitor and only got a new identity through a long struggle with someone who was an antagonist. I think the church can do something very important in its ministry, though, to help people understand and to come to terms with these pressures that come from outside of us, the pressure for the new international economic order, the alliances that the poor are getting together now to put pressure upon the rich. And there's another clue from Bonhoeffer there. He said, the faith demands an elasticity of behavior which is marked by both resistance and submission. And what he meant by that is that lots of things will happen in a crisis time which will call for our resistance. Great injustices will continue. Some of them will, in fact, be the injustices between rich nations and poor nations. That will call for some resistance. But Bonhoeffer also said, we must learn how to submit to the events of our time and see in them the activity of God. So that events about which we become very defensive and pressures that are put upon us to give up this or that, which we feel as threatening, can be interpreted under the understanding of God as judge, and in those circumstances the church can preach a gospel which says submitting to the events of the time is what the Christian ought to do. The most effective kind of change is a change marked by pressure and vision. Unless you have great deal of pressure upon us, unless we the rich have great deals of pressures upon us from without, we won't change our way. But unless we also have some vision that a different way of life lures us, we will resist.
Is good news.
Yeah, it's good news. We will resist those pressures with all that we have. We will do our damnedest to stop them. If you have only pressures and no vision, you get people in a frame of mind of despair and resistance. If you only have vision but no pressures, you only get a very few people responding to the vision. So we can, we have this responsibility in the face of the pressures to hold out a vision and also to help people interpret the pressures. I think it's a re-understanding of Old Testament notion of God as a judge. The dynamics are nicely seen in the exile experience of Israel, where you had the most beautiful vision of hope in the future come from the prophets of the exile, from chiefly second Isaiah, but on both ends, pressure and vision, we've got there is good news.
Time.